If you're listening to this podcast, you probably have an interest in global affairs. My name's Garrison, and I'm the host of The New Diplomatist, and I wanted to say a special thank you to each and every one of you who tune in to listen to the latest interviews with ambassadors, analysts, and experts. But if you're interested in getting even more out of The New Diplomatist, I'd encourage you to visit our Patreon page. A special thank you this month to our ambassador-level supporter, Jeff Flores. Jeff, we appreciate your support. We have a great interview in store for you today. Enjoy. Hello everyone, welcome to the New Diplomatist Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Garrison Morato, and today I'm very honored to have a special guest, the eminent British writer and historian, Andrew Roberts, author of Churchill, Walking with Destiny, as well as the recent book Leadership in War, and many other distinguished works. Mr. Roberts, it is an absolute honor and privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Garrison. It's an honor to be on.
And so, would you mind giving a brief background to the listeners, perhaps, of how you've come to become arguably the preeminent historian of certainly major figures in leadership and war and so on, Churchill and Napoleon. How did you come to this life of being a global author?
Well, first of all, thank you very much indeed for those kind words. I really became a historian because I was useless at everything else. I left university and tried to become an investment banker and actually discovered after a couple of years that I was functionally innumerate. And so I jumped before I was pushed. But I think if I'd stayed any longer in that job, I would undoubtedly have been sacked. And instead started to write history books. And so it was literally through my incompetence at anything else.
I find that hard to believe, but certainly it's been a smashing success for you. One massively acclaimed biography and work after the next. But I did want to ask you, starting about your most recent book, Leadership in War, Essential Lessons from Those Who Made History. You detail certain portions of the decision-making process, the characteristics, the lives of nine major leaders throughout history. And one of the things that fascinated me actually came right at the beginning of the book, where you mention a question that was asked to you. It was an essay question during your university entrance exam, Cambridge, in 1981. And it was pretty simple, but it was also very profound. And it said, how can 100 people be led by a single person? And you said it's fascinated you ever since. And judging by whom you've written about and the way in which you've approached your books, I think that's fairly evident. But could you unpack how that led you to write this book, Leadership in War?
Well, I've been asked by the New York Historical Society to deliver a series of lectures on the concept of individual war leaders. And I was allowed to pick whoever I liked, which was a lovely opportunity, really, to think about leaders I'd known, like Margaret Thatcher, others that I've written about, like Churchill and Napoleon, and then also a few others. I wasn't going to lecture to a New York audience on George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, or FDR. Americans know much more about that than me. And so I decided just to do ones that interested me and that I knew something about and sort of add to the dialogue, as it were. So I chose these nine people, two of them evil dictators in Hitler and Stalin, the rest of them pretty much Democrats. And it was just tremendously intellectually satisfying to be able to write a very short book. I mean, it's only about 150 pages, that one.
It's a very rich 115 pages, I will tell you.
That's very sweet of you. 115 is ears. Very much based on the lectures that I gave this impossibly brainy Upper West Side New York audience.
Absolutely. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is many of the leaders on the roster of subjects within this book, they're fairly notable, as you mentioned, Hitler and Stalin, but also Napoleon, Marshall, Churchill, of course, de Gaulle, Eisenhower, and Nelson. But then the inclusion of Thatcher, obviously, is a significant one. She's arguably one of the top three British prime ministers, certainly of recent history, potentially of all time. But because it is leadership in war, it was a fascinating choice, I think, because the Falklands has significant weight in Britain and in trajectory of their current stance as a modern power, the way that they project themselves on the world stage. But in America, at least, I can say, it's something of a forgotten war for those who weren't alive to witness it on television or remember the news reports. Could you unpack the significance of the Falklands War, not only as a leadership opportunity for Thatcher, but also its continued relevance today?
Yes, in April 1982, the Argentinian junta, the fascist government there, invaded British sovereign territory, these islands off the Argentinian coast called the Falklands Islands. And we, as a world power, really, Britain had been very much on the back foot since the Suez Crisis in 1956. As one of your great Secretaries of State, Dean Acheson, said, we had lost an empire but failed to find a role in the world. Mm-hmm. And that was suddenly and very demonstrably turned upside down by Margaret Thatcher's decision to send the Royal Navy fleet 8,000 miles to expel the Argentinians from the islands that they'd invaded. And it was a touch-and-go operation, as you can imagine, fighting 8,000 miles away from home. It was ultimately extremely successful, and it completely changed the fortunes of the Thatcher ministry, but also the country itself. From then on, we were on a, as you mentioned, trajectory, a far better, far more impressive trajectory than the downhill one where we'd actually just turned into a sort of third stroke, fourth rate power by the time Margaret Thatcher came to power.
And so in particular, I want to zone in just for a moment on a question of the significance, the true significance of deciding to make a fight to defend the Falklands. We mentioned in one of the pages of the book in that section that it would involve putting almost all of Britain's naval forces in one basket, which you mentioned, but it would also cost Britain a fortune during a bad recession. It would be potentially unpopular internationally, could strain relations with the United States, whose ambassador to the UN, Jean Kirkpatrick, was known to favor the Argentinians, I believe by my other readings, because she believed them to be anti-communist. And there was, of course, always the danger of suffering defeat at the hands of Argentina's large surface fleet, four submarines, armed forces entrenched on the islands, and their 200 modern warplanes flown by brave and resourceful pilots. And I couldn't help but picture that meeting, that war meeting she had with her defense ministers, and not think back to some of your writings in Churchill, your biography on Churchill, where it was very much a decision taken against the advice of those closest to each of those respective leaders at a time of crisis to go ahead and make a fight in the face of aggression. Could you unpack those moments of leadership and their significance?
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. Of course, Margaret Thatcher hugely admired Winston Churchill when she was a young girl. She was born in 1926. When she was a young 16-year-old girl, she was listening to the radio in the Second World War with her family in 1942, listening to Winston Churchill's speeches and so on, and admired him greatly. And she reacted with the Churchillian splendour, really, when this, as I say, totalitarian dictatorship attacked Britons who were living on this island thousands of miles away. It's the same response that Winston Churchill would have given, did give, of course. And it was very much driven by her innate belief that the British people had the right to live in freedom. And, of course, that's one of the things that she took from Winston Churchill. So the overlaps are enormous, and so are the echoes of her speeches during the Falklands crisis. One can hear the distinct echo of Winston Churchill in what she said and did.
And I'm struck by statements you've made in past interviews as well as in these two books about the significance of a continuity or a line of British history, that there was very much a sense of, you call it destiny with Churchill, I would say even responsibility with Thatcher, to uphold a tradition dating all the way back to the threat of British invasion from the Spanish Armada, all the way up through Napoleon and other examples, to stand firm against aggression. That's inbred in British political thought for these leaders. But it's also an aspect of leadership. In the last chapter you have on the book Leadership and War, you mentioned this quote from Churchill, which he made in May of 1953, where he says, study history, in history lie all the secrets of statecraft. And you add, and the same is true of statecraft's vital subsection, war leadership. And yet, history seems to be one of the most overlooked subjects in public discussion, and certainly in public education, at least speaking for America, that I can name today. What would you say about the importance of bringing history back, not only for statecraft, but also for leadership as a study?
I'm glad you mentioned that and quoted that line of Churchill's, which he made, actually, funny enough, to an American student as he was crossing Westminster Hall on the day of Majesty the Queen's coronation. And I think it's vital, and it's rather shocking, in Britain certainly, the level of historical ignorance on behalf of people, you know, who should know better, as it were. There was quite recently a poll taken of British school children, 20, by children I mean sort of 16 to 18 year olds, 20% of whom thought that Winston Churchill was a fictional character.
Oh my gosh, wow.
I know. The same, 47% of them thought that Eleanor Rigby was a real person, and 53% thought that Sherlock Holmes was a real person.
Wow.
So, you know, we have an extraordinary thing. Quite recently also, in a separate and different poll, I still laugh at this, although actually it's completely terrifying, really. Some 30% of the young people, you know, they're not children, they're young people at 16 to 18, 30% thought that the American War of Independence had been won by Denzel Washington.
Oh my gosh.
So look, it's absolutely vital. If people in a democracy are going to be able to make the correct choices and understand what's going on in the world, they have to know about the past. They have to know about what people did on the planet before they entered it. And at the moment, I don't think that's being taught properly, at least not in schools. I think that it is by the popular teaching. I think, you know, lots of people are watching history on television, lots of people are reading and buying, thank God, history books. And so on that side of things...
Well, you're making that process much easier for us by writing one, so...
Thank you. Well, yes. There's a genuine thirst, you know, for history out there, but I don't think it's one that at least the British state is doing enough about in the schools.
Well, I can certainly second that and probably sound even... If I had the polls in front of me, I'm sure we have far worse numbers even on this side of the Atlantic.
Not 30% think that Denzel Washington...
Well, perhaps not on that, but the Churchill numbers might be worse, though, and same for Thatcher. But, to further probe this question philosophically about history, you mentioned, turning to your magnificent work on Churchill, Walking with Destiny, you mentioned that he got the three big questions of his lifetime correct. Prussian militarists in World War One, Nazi Germany, obviously, and World War II being the most famous, but also Soviet communism. And the thing I'm struck most by, each of these are very distinct threats that they're different from each other in various ways, but there's also a shocking similarity, isn't there, on some level, to the way in which the world plunged towards catastrophe twice and potential catastrophe a third time in the Cold War. Yet many times he's the lone voice speaking out against the threat, trying to warn people, trying to prep people. And yet those surrounding him, even as late as the third crisis with communism, whether it's Harry Truman or others, they were not prepared to follow him in recognizing the threat. And they had just lived through two rounds of some of the biggest threats of the last several hundred years. What is that particular trait of Churchill that allowed him to see above what those around him either could not see or would not see? And how did he bring forward that historical and even contemporary experience to leadership?
Well, I think certainly with regard to the Second World War, he had three areas, three things that set him apart. The first was he was an historian. He had looked, as you mentioned, at these dangers posed by the Spanish Armada, by Louis XIV of France, by Napoleon and the Kaiser in the First World War. And of course, he himself had fought in the trenches in the First World War. And so he was able to use this historical understanding and background and knowledge to place the threat of posed by Hitler and the Nazis into the overarching historical panoply of previous threats. Second thing was that he was a Philo-Semite. He liked Jews. He'd grown up with Jews. He'd gone on holiday with them. His father liked Jews. He thought that they were the absolute sort of equal of in the Judeo-Christian cultural civilizational background to everything that he believed in. And so as a result, he had an early warning system when it came to Hitler and the Nazis that was not vouchsafed to a large number of other people in upper class Britain at the time, who I'm afraid were anti-Semitic. And then the third thing is that he could see fanaticism. He'd seen it up close and personal in his own life when he was fighting in the Sudan and elsewhere, and he recognised it again in the Nazis. And so with that particular threat, you can see where his sort of understanding came from. With regard to communism, really, it's the same kind of thing as the Nazis. He recognised the threat to democracy from totalitarian dictatorship, in this case Stalin's, which he didn't consider morally to be hugely different from that of Adolf Hitler, and we obviously know now that he was right about that too. So it's something that's part of the sort of wellspring of his belief in freedom and democracy, that he was able to spot these threats to both so early on. And he was one of the only people who did as well in both cases.
You know, I think that last point in particular is the one I'm most fascinated by for the present day as well, to contextualize this conversation even to our era, which is not only Churchill but also Thatcher. They recognized the threats largely in part, as you mentioned, because they knew what they believed in and that what they saw was not that. And I think that, to me at least, is one of the things that perhaps we've slowly lost or considerably lost in the Western world today, in the English-speaking world. You know, Churchill writing the four-volume History of the English-Speaking Peoples. You yourself, sir, adding a fifth volume since 1900, also an acclaimed book of yours. But that view that the English-speaking peoples, the Anglosphere, as you might call it, do have something to offer, something significant in freedom, in democracy, in voting. Do you feel that we've lost some of that belief system, and what might be the way to bring it back?
I do, rather, yes. People will, and you mentioned it earlier about Harry Truman, people, although he was a strong anti-communist when it came to 1949 and the creation of NATO and so on, back at the time that Churchill made the Iron Curtain speech in March 1946, he wanted to try to continue to appease the Soviet Union. And there is no point in trying to do that to totalitarian countries if you know that ultimately they want your downfall. It's much better to stand up against them, not only because it means that your allies will be much tougher and less demoralized, but also because it's simply the right thing to do. And I would like it if more people in the world, more world leaders, did actually make it quite clear and say much more loudly than they do that democracy is better than any other system so far tried. It's not really said enough, really. People are too worried about undermining their position with the totalitarian powers. And as soon as you get to that stage, you've lost the initiative. You're on the back foot.
And, you know, it reminds me of a recent debate I had on Twitter, actually, with a former naval officer who's an analyst in Singapore. We were discussing the American-Chinese competition currently underway in trade, in technology, even in military competition. Some have even called it, like Niall Ferguson, I believe, was one of the historians who said it's the beginnings of a second Cold War. And I argued with him that we had a significant ideological difference with China that could not be easily reconciled, and that we would have to oppose them in that, just as we did the Soviet Union. And he said something to me that I found fascinating. He said, good luck in applying a decades-old paradigm to the present day. And it was very much, for me, it's encapsulated this view that history, you know, it may be relevant, but it's not that relevant to the modern day. What would you say to that idea?
Well, I'd say that there's a reason why it's worked for decades. You know,
yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Just because a paradigm is old doesn't mean it's wrong. It might actually mean that it's tried and trusted.
Yes, I like that.
And there's a lot to it as a result. And frankly, sticking up for freedom and democracy, the idea that you can just dismiss that as old hat is absurd. Because actually it's something that the majority of people in the world want. They haven't got it necessarily. You have to be tremendously brave. Look at these young people in Hong Kong at the moment.
Yes.
You have to be
yes,
incredibly
indeed.
Gutsy to stand up and demand democracy. Of course you do. And that's why these people should be supported, in my view.
And now I want to take you in the direction of discussing another idea about the Anglosphere. But before I do, you did mention Hong Kong. Given that you did literally write the book section on leadership in war with Thatcher, what do you think her stance would be in relation to Hong Kong, were she alive today, and certainly even if she was prime minister or could be prime minister today, having been integral in that handing over process to China? How do you feel she would have approached that?
Well, of course, she was a huge believer in the rule of law, and the law was that we had to hand back Hong Kong. She tried to do the best deal she possibly could with the basic law. She got a very good deal until the Chinese very recently just ripped it up.
Yes.
Obviously, you know, 30-plus years later after they signed it. She, I think, would have been absolutely in the forefront of those people, those amongst us who think that we should offer British passports to the Hong Kong people if they are treated as badly as I rather fear that they might be in the future, then they should be allowed to come over here. And she would have supported that. In fact, her vicars on earth, as it were, her strongest supporters in Britain, they are the people who are calling for that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And now, continuing on this present theme of applying Churchill, applying Thatcher to the present day, on the topic of Brexit and on Britain's current role in the world today. I know in a recent interview you were challenged by someone who said that Winston Churchill's grandson is a Remainer. Would Churchill be the same? And you had an interesting answer, and I'm curious to expand that slightly and say, I believe I heard, sir, that you yourself were pro-Brexit, pro-Leave. How would you apply Churchill and Thatcher's views if they were here in the modern day to the issue of Brexit, which of course is now underway, but how it might be managed and whether or not it was their ideological stance?
Well, Winston Churchill's daughter, Mary Soames, told me never to assume you know what Papa would have thought under any circumstances, especially half a century after he died.
Yes.
So, you know, one has to fit the caveat onto that before answering that question. And one also has to remember that, of course, he was in many ways the founder of the concept of United Europe. He made these speeches at The Hague and Salzburg and elsewhere, came up with the idea of Europe uniting, because he had seen twice in his lifetime friends, many friends of his, die in the wars essentially between France and Germany. And so he never wanted to see that happen again. He didn't, however, believe that Britain should be a member of this European project. He saw Britain as being at the centre of concentric circles with the special relationship with the United States, the relationship that we have with the Commonwealth countries such as Australia and Canada and New Zealand and so on, and also a friendship and alliance with Europe, is why he's such a big supporter of NATO. But he certainly didn't think that another entity like Brussels should be able to make laws for Britain which override domestic law. That was something that he was never in favour of.
And so since we are at a position now where Britain has stepped away from the European Union, is in some of the final trade negotiations, or what people are hoping is some of the final trade negotiations for what that relationship looks like post-Brexit. You wrote a fascinating article recently in the Wall Street Journal called "It's Time to Revive the Anglosphere. The UK should form a new union with Canada, Australia, and New Zealand to work as a global partner of the United States." And I was fascinated not only by your article, but also the history I had not previously heard of. A little differently, of course, back in the day, it being suggested an imperial federation back when there was still the British Empire. But this is sort of the modern and evolved version of that Commonwealth structure.
To make it clear, it's got nothing to do with
empire. Oh, no, of course not.
Very much dead, yes, no. Dead and buried.
Yes. But that unification of uniting the efforts of the English-speaking peoples towards democracy, I guess, is more what I'm saying, not the empire part.
Precisely, and not just democracy. I mean, there are lots of countries in the world that have got that as well, but we also have a common law in those countries that you mentioned. We've got a common language, of course, literature, in lots of areas, such as intelligence, with the Five Eyes, in intelligence, with nuclear cooperation, with massive trade cooperation. We have got much more in common. Britain has much more in common with Canada, New Zealand and Australia than it has with most of the European countries of the European Union. And I would argue also with our special relationship with America over the last nearly 100 years now, we've actually got something that's much more important as well, which is a voice which is all too easily sort of drowned out in Brussels, but which is listened to still, I believe, in the Oval Office and has been, you know, as I say, for a century. And so I much prefer the concept of moving it, being friendly to all, you know, we're not antagonistic towards Brussels. We just simply don't have as much in common with them as we do with you and with the Commonwealth.
And how do you feel that the current approach of Prime Minister Johnson has been so far to Brexit? Do you see his relationships with the other Commonwealth nations, with Canada and Australia and New Zealand, do you see that as going in a productive direction that might help formulate such an Anglosphere, or do you think there needs to be adjustments?
No, I'm very happy. I don't know. I mean, this is the week, isn't it? This week and next week is the week that they're going to come to an agreement or not. I hope that he still has the guts to walk away. He said it many, many times that he would if the European Union doesn't give us the same kind of deal that it's willing to give Canada and various other countries. If it tries to punish Britain for having left the European Union, then I think it'll be cutting off its nose to spite its face, because it does want to have a good trading relationship with the fifth largest economy in the world, which is Britain. So it strikes me that this is the week that we'll see whether or not Boris gets a decent free trade agreement. I hope he does. But if he doesn't, I hope he's got the guts to sort of go out into the cold. It won't be nice for very long, but then we are actually trying to get our independence back now. You know, it wasn't very nice for Americans in 1776 and, you know, Valley Forge either, was it? But nonetheless, you did it. You did it and you won your independence. And so I think we should be able to put up with a few sort of long lorry lines at the South Coast ports and so on, if we're actually trying to get something as important as our sovereignty.
And going back to that issue of sovereignty, this will be one of our last questions because I do want to be respectful of your time, sir, but you did mention again in that final chapter, the leadership paradigm, within your latest book, Leadership in War, you mentioned the leader necessarily deals to a large extent in symbols and images and in the sort of galvanizing idea that becomes a force of history. People are persuaded by reason, but moved by emotion. And I believe that that probably was a core part of the leave argument as well in Brexit. But it's also necessary to leadership more broadly in the West. Do you feel that that is something that is still largely present in our current political leadership in Britain and in the United States? Or do we need something of a renaissance of leadership that appeals to the heart as well as the mind?
Well, I hope I didn't go too far on that argument, because it does strike me also that there's a perfectly sort of cold, blooded, practical reason why Britain needs to be independent. We actually, independent countries do better the ones that are in sort of agglomeration of states.
Oh, absolutely.
Look at Greece, look at Portugal, look at Italy and Spain. You know, the fact that they are in the European Union was the reason. They've had such a terrible time economically recently. So I don't want in any way to imply that it's all about the past and about, you know, emotions and so on. There's a sort of clinical reason why it's better. Brexit will be better for Britain in the long run as well. But having said all that, of course, ultimately, the way in which you see your country and the way you look at the future is going to be something that is a visceral sense, one that does come from the gut. And it strikes me that as a result, America and Britain have got so many things that they've got right in the world. When you look at the whole of the rest of the world with so many other terrible, monstrous tyrannies that there are, we have tended to get it right and must continue to do that, because otherwise, my God, you only have to look around to see that way madness lies.
It's very, very much true. And for the final question, speaking about the future, as you have in that last statement, we've got these magnificent books on our shelves: Napoleon, A Life, Churchill, Walking with Destiny, most recently Leadership in War, and many others I know as well. It's a very long list of distinguished works you've produced. What can readers look forward to from Andrew Roberts in the future for a next book? I've heard before something about maybe the Duke of Marlborough, but I've also heard something on the internet, I don't know if it's true or not, about George III. So where are we at now?
Yes, I have actually, funnily enough, only last week put the last word onto a full-scale cradle-to-the-grave biography of King George III, which America is going to be published this time next year, in November 2021. It's going to be called Last King of America, which I think will...
Wonderful, very catchy title. Yes,
yeah, exactly. Yes. It's going to try and argue that George III was not the tyrant of the Declaration of Independence, and certainly not the villain of Hamilton the musical, but in fact was a Renaissance prince. He was an enlightened monarch, somebody who actually, I think, deserves another look.
Wonderful. Well, perhaps this time next year, sir, if you're willing, we can have you back for an in-depth book review on The Last King of America, because now I'm fascinated, and we'll definitely pre-order that the moment that I can. So we appreciate you
Garrison,
giving a sneak peek.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, I would love to do that, and thanks very much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. We appreciate it, sir.